through this wonderful book of beginnings in Genesis 44. The title of our message is When God Tests the Heart. And through all of this process of the family dynamics that are going on, we see that God is at work. He's at work giving Joseph these desires to test his brothers' hearts. And how much of this is Joseph's desire to probe and the conscience of his brothers to see if they really have changed over 20 years? Because this is the bottom line. You know that you're not the same person you were 20 years ago. You who are middle-aged can look back over the last 20, 25 years of your life, and you see who you were back then. Last night I said, you're not the same person you were 20 years ago. And a gal in the middle said, praise the Lord. You're kind of like, so thankful that God had changed her heart and her life. But that really works both ways, doesn't it? The human life, no man or woman, is ever static, meaning that we're either moving ahead in the things of the Lord or we're moving away from the things of the Lord. You see, your life and my life through the seasons, and life has its seasons, doesn't it? The busy years of when your kids are young and you're just scrambling to, you're really frazzled in those early years. And then as the house begins to be empty, that's a new season, and one by one those tax deductions leave and you sit there at the door. You're waving goodbye. The seasons of life can find us in different places. 20 years ago, you may have been far from the Lord, and here this morning, man, you have this love for Jesus. But it could be that this morning finds your heart far from the things of God, and you can look back when you were 20 years old and you had an intimate, passionate relationship with God. And it's grown cold, and you've grown distant, and you've allowed sin to come into your life and bring bondage where there once was such a joyful freedom. You see, none of us are in a place of static. We're always moving in our walk with the Lord. But God's desire is that we change from glory to glory as we with unveiled faces behold the glory of the Lord, meaning that when we grow in our walk with the Lord, He's just constantly transforming us. But this chapter is a test of the heart, as well as the last chapter. The last chapter finishes off by Joseph giving five times the amount of dinner servings to Benjamin, the little brother. What's the test? The test is, are these brothers still envious of the favored, pampered son? And Joseph has a test for them here. He's going to frame them. He does a frame job on them, basically to convict them of something they haven't done, to see how they're going to react when it comes to either leaving Benjamin behind because they still have not changed, they do not care, or seeing if they're going to come to his rescue because they have changed. And it comes from an unlikely source in this man that we'll look at towards the end of our message, named Judah. And so let's look at, first of all, them being framed by Joseph. Number two, the grieving of the brothers over this conviction of crime, even though they're innocent of it. And thirdly, the intercession that Judah goes through with such intimacy and passion. Let's first of all look at the frame that Joseph is going to design. In verse 1 of chapter 44, it says, "And he commanded the steward of his house, saying, fill the men's sacks with food, as much as they can carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack. Also put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest, and his grain money." So he did according to the word that Joseph had spoken. As soon as the morning dawned, the men were sent away, they and their donkeys. When they had gone out of the city and were not far off, Joseph said to his steward, "Get up, follow the men, and when you overtake them, say to them, 'Why have you repaid evil for good? Is not this the one from which my Lord drinks and with which he indeed practices divination? You have done evil in so doing.' So he overtook them and he spoke to them these same words." See, the day before at their noon luncheon, they had a feast. They drank wine. It says that they were merry. There was joy. There was gladness. Because I think they finally think that they've escaped the bullet of this somewhat agitated Egyptian ruler that they do not know as their brother Joseph. They brought Benjamin. He's seen Benjamin. And now it appears after this meal that they're going to be able to go home and breathe a huge sigh of relief that all of this drama that has taken several months to play out is finally over. But that night, unbeknownst to the brothers, Joseph comes up with a plan and he tells the servant, the steward, he says, now I want you to go back and put all the money in their sacks. And then I want you to take my silver cup and I want you to stuff it in the sack of the youngest boy, Benjamin, and then load them up. And in the morning, they wake him up and say, up and at him, get out of here, hit the road. And these guys, no doubt, are going down the road with their donkeys, breathing a sigh of relief, like, whew, good riddance to Egypt. And the ruler back there that called us spies and all the drama of that for the last couple of months, finally we get to go back to our quiet life in Canaan. But about that time, Joseph sends the Egyptian posse after them. He tells his steward, okay, they're down the road a little ways, chase them down. Now that's never a fun experience, is it? Do you like that police officer behind you with his lights going? I mean, and if it's going to rev up from there to search and seizure type of experience. And if you've ever had those dramas, it's not a fun experience. Anxiety, your blood pressure raises and you're just panicked. I was just in Prague last month and this police officer pulls in front of Jason's driving, and this police officer pulls in front of him and then off to the side of the road. We're going about 25. He just pulls off. And they have this cool new technology there, I guess, because out of the back of their lighting system on top of the car, it says in bright red letters, stop. And so when they approach you from the front, they just pull over in front of you and then flash this word that says stop. And then he pulled over to the side of the road. And the normal check with good common sense follows the police officer. Stupid Americans don't do that because we don't know any better. The cop pulls over and it flashes stop on the top of the lights, and Jason doesn't see it. And I said, it said stop on top of his lights. And Jason said, I wonder what he's doing. I said, I don't know. And we just kept cruising. The next time he was not so subtle. I mean, siren and lights and blaring, and we're pulling over. Wonder who's he's after. He's after the stupid Americans. That's who he's after. So we pull over, and if you haven't traveled very much extensively, interacting with officials in foreign country is a little unnerving, because first of all, you cannot communicate, right? So the police officer comes back there and check, and what he's doing is he's totally telling Jason off, why did you not stop when I flashed you the stop sign on the back of my car? And he's like, and Jason's like, I don't know. I'm like, we've been putting you through language school for a year and a half. You don't know what he's saying? You know? No good. What we do know is the one word that I learned there, and that is bad, is spotney. I'm thinking, spotney, this is bad, this is very bad. And so Jason, he gets out his cell phone, and this guy's still telling him off, and he starts dialing. I said, what are you doing? You got your cell phone out? You act like you... And he said, I'm calling Martin. And so he calls his friend, and he hands the phone to the police officer, and he tells him, Martin, please find out why I'm in trouble. And so the police officer talks to him on the cell phone because da-da-da-da, and he gives it back to him. It was quite an experience. But I was just waiting for the next step, is that, you know, get out, put your hands on the hood, see what's going to happen. Missionaries arrested in the Czech Republic for being just stupid Americans, basically. And you think about these Hebrews coming out of this foreign land, out of Egypt, and they think they're finally escaping the drama that's been going on with this irritable leader, prime minister of Egypt by the name of, we know it's Joseph, they don't know it's their brother. And he pulls them over, so to speak, and he says, hey, you guys have stolen my master's silver cup. Now, they're so indignant, they know, all of them know, all 11 of the brothers know they have not done this. And why would they be so stupid to do it? They're just trying to escape with their lives. Who would want to go and steal something? Now, these brothers had some serious character flaws, but stealing doesn't apparently be one of them. And so notice how strongly they, in a sense, they're defensive and they're angry with the Egyptian leader or steward. It says in verse 7, and they said to him, why does my Lord say these words? Far be it from us that your servant should do such a thing. And he says down here in verse 10, now also let it be according to your words. He with whom it is found shall be my slave, and you shall be blameless. The steward responds to them saying, basically, in that verse in between, that may the person who has the silver cup die, and the rest of us will be your slaves. Now that's some pretty strong confidence. Now, the drama from the last couple of months should have revealed to them not to be quite so cocky and sure of themselves, correct? Because somebody's been messing with them, putting money in the sack and putting money back in the sack and all of these things. So they let down the sacks very quickly. And as they let them, he starts with the oldest. He goes from Reuben, he goes to Simeon, he goes to Levi, he goes to Judah. He makes his way through the sons of basically the concubines. He gets down to the end to Benjamin, and he opens a sack, and voila, silver cup. Now, don't you know the brothers that just so with great confidence said, "May whoever has the silver cup die." They had passed sentence on themselves, if you will. Well, specifically, Benjamin. But we see from the divine setup, or this, at least Joseph's setup and this frame job, now the brothers grieve. For it says in verse 13, "Then they tore their clothes, and each man loaded his donkey and returned to the city. So Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house, and he was still there. And they fell before him on the ground. Joseph said to them, 'What deed is this you have done? Did you not know that such a man as I can certainly practice divination?' Then Judah said, 'What shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak? Or how shall we clear ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Here we are, my Lord's slaves, both we and he also with whom the cup was found.'" Now, an unlikely individual steps up. You see, they're grieved. They tear their clothes. That practice of tearing your clothes in the Middle Eastern culture is a picture of, like, now my heart is ripped apart, and I'm going to show you what's going on in the inside with such strong, violent emotion. I'm going to rip my clothes on the outside. And that tells us right away that these brothers have changed somewhat from who they were 22 years earlier. Because the only one that tore his clothes when the whole thing happened with Joseph was Jacob. Jacob loved Joseph, and when he thought that a wild animal had destroyed him, it says Jacob tore his clothing. But the other brothers who had set Joseph up and sold him into slavery, basically, they weren't tearing their clothes. They were saying good riddance to that arrogant little 17-year-old. They'd had enough of him. And yet, over this 22 years, something has happened in the process of transformation. As you see, the story of Joseph, there's so much focus on him that sometimes we forget or negate or neglect the fact that God is also working in the brothers' lives, bringing them into a greater maturity. And somewhere in that 20 years, something has happened that basically has helped them deal with the bitterness of seeing the obvious, blatant favoritism of their father to a brother. And that's a hard pill to swallow for brothers and sisters. It's something you got to deal with or can create bitterness for years to come. And here, they might have thought that when they got rid of Joseph, they got rid of the favored son. But what Jacob did, because Jacob is prone to this weakness as a father, showing such blatant, obvious favoritism, that he just transferred all of the favoritism he had on Joseph since he lost him, now to Benjamin. So those brothers didn't get rid of anything. Now they've got to face it all over again. Now he begins to dote on Benjamin. Now, though, we don't see him getting the coat of many colors or this or that, but he begins to dote on Benjamin, that he's the youngest, he's the baby boy, and he's his favorite. So now the brother's got to deal with a whole new wave of favoritism. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with, in your family, when there's this obvious intimacy and favoritism for one of your brothers or one of your sisters over you? Now, it's not that big a deal for the pampered, favored one. You might be that individual. Oh, yeah, my dad loves me more than the rest. What's the problem? Is there anything wrong with that? No, because you see, you're the apple of their eye. You're the one that is receiving the focus. You're receiving the attentiveness. You're the one that's receiving all of the blessing that comes with being under the experience of their love. But the ones that feel like they're on the outs, they're the ones that are, no matter how bad they want to, they cannot seem to enter that circle of intimacy. How do you deal with that? Does 20 years make a difference? Can you go back when you're 45 and have Thanksgiving dinner and still see the same blatant favoritism be okay with it?
You see, something seemed to be happening in these brothers' lives because now they're willing to lay their life on the line. They're actually tearing their clothes. They're actually grieved when this favored son looks like he's going to go into slavery. You see, if they were the same guys, they would just say, all right, strike two, got rid of the other little jerk. Let's go home, guys. But they don't. They are now following. They are now begging. They are now groveling on their face before Joseph to somehow have Benjamin freed. That's what you call changed lives. Because somewhere along the line, you know, you just have to become okay that there are going to be people in your life. It might be the favored son or daughter in the workplace. You know, a manager has somebody that seems to be their pet. They get all of the great jobs. You get all the lousy jobs. You know, somewhere in life, you just got to face it and let it go and just say, Lord, it's all good. It's, you know, I'm not going to lose any sleep. I'm not going to lose any anxiety or bitterness over this issue. And so you just let go. And it's a very freeing thing when you can live life being very comfortable with who God is and who He's making you into be and the inconsistency of human love and relationship. It's called maturity. You just got to grow up. You just got to be able to deal with it and let it go and just, you know what? It's all good. I know Dad loves Benjamin more than me. So what? So what? So somewhere in the process, the brothers have grown. And so now they're groveling before Joseph. And Judah's the unlikely one because, you see, Judah steps up now to defend Benjamin. And he's the one that it was his idea to sell him in the first place, if you remember the account. It was Judah who said, hey, let's not kill the little twerp. Let's make some cash. That was Judah. Now, Judah steps up and he has just broken all of his brothers. And as far as they know, maybe Benjamin did steal the cup. The evidence is there, right? It's like DNA. He's got the cup in his sack. Why would you do that, Benjamin? But he doesn't go there with it. He just says in verse 16, what shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak? Or how shall we clear ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. What Judah now does is he brings God into this experiment of his testing and says, you know what? I think God's behind all of this. I think God is bringing discipline. I think God is dealing with our hearts because of what we did with Joseph so long ago. And I think it's so important for us if we're really going to experience growth in our life as we experience the pressures and the certain pressure points of life that we acknowledge. We finally look up and we say, Lord, what are you doing? What do you want me to learn? How do you want me to grow in this? And we bring God into the mix that you see, God is working in your life. I don't care how far you feel like you are from the Lord here today. God is working. God is dealing with your heart. God is testing your heart. He's turning up the heat sometimes so that you can face yourself in the mirror and see the selfishness of your own heart and how it's hurting other people. I mean, he just turns up the heat sometimes. And he wants us to grow in the process. And so Judah acknowledges that God is in this whole thing. Now, this is the fascinating thing, that as Judah steps up, because Judah, back in chapter 38, once again, he's not the same guy. The Judah that married the ungodly Canaanite woman, which he was not supposed to. The Lord had already told the family of Abraham and Isaac and them not to marry the ladies of the land because they were given over to worshiping false gods. But he did it anyway. He separated from his family. If you will, Judah backslid. Judah grew up knowing about the true and living God. And Judah just said, you know what? Forget my family and all of their godliness and worshiping the true and living God. And I'm going to do my own thing. How often you see that in somebody's family? Because somebody, maybe they've been raised in church and my parents crammed that stuff down my throat my whole life. Now I'm going to get out there and really see what's going on. And off they go. And they go get a big old dose of the world. And it's, you know, my parents said this drinking thing was bad. I'm going to go check it out, see if it's as bad as they say. And they, you know, you can go through the list. And sometimes what people need, and not to encourage that, but is a big, strong dose of the grossness of sin. Because once they face it, they come back and go, you know, it's just as sick as they said it was. And the guilt and the shame and the circumstance. So that's what happened to Judah. Judah went and married an ungodly girl. He had ungodly kids, so much so it says his firstborn, Ur, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord just snuffed him out, just killed him. That's, you think your teenager's bad. That's seriously bad when God just fries your oldest, you know what I mean? You don't worry about taking away the car keys. God just torched him right in the front yard. Wow, it's worse than I thought. And then his second is no better. God struck and killed him too. I mean, you started off with three tax deductions. By the time God's done, you only got one. He's got his youngest. And then you know the story. But just to rehearse, because I think it's paramount that it's very fresh in your mind, who is now interceding and who is a different guy, just to paint that black backdrop of who he was 20 years earlier. And then because he doesn't give his youngest son to his daughter-in-law Tamar, she understands it. She dresses up and disguises herself with a veil over her face as a Canaanite prostitute. And she propositions her father-in-law, Judah. He goes into her. They have sexual relations. She gets pregnant by her father-in-law. This is the guy that's going to play the hero in this story. Huh? How's a guy get so messed up, get so far from God, and then all of a sudden step up? Because time changes us when God is working in our lives. We're not the same people as God begins his transforming work. What does Paul the Apostle tell us in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 17? We are new creations in Christ. Those who have come to Jesus, we're a brand new creation. Old things have passed away. Behold, all things have become new. We're new people. We're different people. And Judah seems to be on her path of standing up and actually having a spiritual backbone, a backbone of character that is out of character from the earlier stories that we've seen of Judah. And so now Judah's great declaration, or his experience to want to share, as it says, starting off in verse 30, "Now therefore, when I come to your servant, my father," these are Judah's words. "Now therefore, when I come to your servant, my father, and the lad is not with us, since his life is bound up in the lad's life, it will happen when he sees that the lad is not with us that he will die. So your servant will bring down the gray hair of your servant, our father, with sorrow to the grave. For your servant became surety for the lad to my father, saying, 'If I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father forever. Now, therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the lad as a slave to my lord, and let the lad go up with his brothers. For how shall I go up to my father if the lad is not with me, lest perhaps I see the evil that would come upon my father?'" Judah here plays the incredible hero. As a matter of fact, it is an illustration in the Bible of the truth that Jesus taught his disciples, "Greater love hath no man but to lay down his life for his friends." Jesus said that one of the greatest examples in all of life about love is that when a person sees a brother, sees a friend, sees somebody in desperate need, and they somehow have the means or the opportunity or the resource to step up and to lay their life down instead. To have their life count for something that is absolutely selfless. That's what Judah does here. You see, Judah doesn't know that this is Genesis 44, and it's all going to turn out happily ever after. Judah doesn't know that. What's Judah think? Judah thinks, "I'm going to be a slave the rest of my life. If this prime minister of Egypt will allow me to do a substitution and exchange, if my little brother Benjamin really did steal the silver cup, because he doesn't know all the circumstance, if he really does, if I could step in his place, and if I could take the crime on myself, if I could take the penalty on myself, if I could take the punishment on myself, and I can send Benjamin home to his father in peace, that's what I want to do." It is truly the heroic thing. I don't think Judah is thinking that I'm going to play the hero or I'm going to do some grandiose things. Paul the Apostle likewise said, you know, "Scarcely for a righteous man would somebody dare to die. But Jesus died for us while we were yet sinners." What Paul was saying is a similar truth. Just think about it. Who in your life are you willing, to literally die for? Who would you give your life for? Now, most of us would probably go through those intimate relationships that are closest. My wife, my husband, my kids, my grandkids, most certainly my grandkids, grandparents would say. And, or my mom or my dad or whoever it is. But really, honestly, it's highly unlikely that you can fill up two handfuls of who you would be willing to die for, right? Now, that's the most intimate, loving relationships that mean the absolute most to you on planet Earth. But then if I was to turn and ask, yeah, would you die for their murderer in prison? Would you die for the rapist? Would you die for the serial killer? Would you die for Osama bin Laden? No way, man. Let them folks die. Let them die. Why? Because we think to ourselves, I mean, these most intimate relationships, I'm willing to lay my life down for them. But the unrighteous and the ungodly and the wicked, I mean, I'm not going to die for those guys. Good riddance. And yet in this story, Judah not only steps up as the hero, but we see an Old Testament allusion and picture of the ultimate one that was going to come a couple of thousand years later, Jesus. From the tribe of Judah. We know him as the Lion of the tribe of Judah. And in essence, is that not exactly what Jesus has done for you and I? You and I, unlike Benjamin, have stolen the silver cup. Every one of us in this room are sinners. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. There is none righteous, no, not one. You and I have sinned in our thoughts. We've sinned in our words. We've sinned in our actions. We've sinned with our hands. Our feet have taken to sinful places. We are hook, line, and sinker from beginning to end. We are fallen, flawed, sinful creatures. And yet the Lion of the tribe of Judah steps up for us just like Judah does for Benjamin. And he steps up in that place and he says, you know, I'm going to take their place, Father. And this was the Father's heart, that he so loved us that he sent his Son. So it's definitely a plan of the triune God. The Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit are in this agreement that this is the only way to save men and women. And so you and I were headed for judgment. We were headed to face the great white throne judgment of God that we see that is a startling, scary place in Revelation chapter 20. And we were going to give an account for our own sins, but Jesus stepped into our place. He said, I will take the spikes in the hands. I will take the spikes in the feet. I will wear the crown of thorns upon my head. I will allow them to scourge my back. And they plucked his beard out of his face. They spit in his face. They struck him over and over and mocked him as he was blindfolded, saying, hey, prophesy, who struck you? If you're the king of the Jews, if you're this great prophet. And they totally mocked him. And yet Jesus was innocent. He had never sinned. You see, if you love Jesus here today, it is for this simple reason. He took your place. Greater love hath no man but to lay down his life for his friends. And my friend, Jesus, laid his life down for me so that I did not have to face the judgment of God. That's why I love him. That's why I serve him. That's why I sing to him. That's why my life is his. Because there's something incredibly endearing when somebody lays their life down for you. And I think as Joseph is looking at Judah laying his life down for Benjamin, I think Joseph's in awe. This is not the brother Judah that I know. He's a different guy. Because there's something that just stirs your heart in that essence of being very much a hero in spiritual things. Probably why through the years my brother Scotty and I have been so close. Because growing up in the rough and tumble of kind of the streets, my brother has laid his life down for me many times. I mean, literally taking beatings for me that were rightfully mine. And stepping up, well, it all started because, you know, when I was 8 years old, we had moved to North Hollywood, California, which is a beautiful neck of the woods, if those are familiar to Southern Cal. And I took my first good beating at 8. And this kid held me down, had his knees on my arms and hit me in the face over and over and just hit me in the nose. I had blood everywhere. Well, he had several friends that were standing around my older brother, Scott. And they were just waiting for him to move so that they could pound him. And Scott, with good logic, I mean, there's no sense in both of us getting beat up. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense.
You know, I understand his reasoning. And so he watched me take a good pounding. So I got up. This kid finally got bored with my blood and everything. And so he let me up. And I ran home to my mom crying like a baby, 8 years old. Come in the house, and I had blood from my nose all over my face. And my mom's like, what happened to you? What happened to you? And I said, oh, this kid beat me up out there, Bob, and he hit me over and over in the face. And I'd never really been beat up good at the age of 8. So this was a new experience. And so my brother kind of sheepishly walks in behind me, and my mom, who was just livid, you know, those mother bear, she bear kind of experiences you moms get if somebody touches your baby, and I'm the youngest of four, so I am the baby. And she looks at my brother, and with, you know, my mom is a very laid back person, so it takes a lot to get her worked up. She looked at him, she says, where were you? To Scotty. He goes, I was standing right there. She said, well, where's your blood? And he goes, Mom, there's these couple of guys, and they were bigger than me, and they're standing around. They're just waiting for me to do something. They're going to pound me, too. And, and she looked at me, she said, if your little brother comes home with blood, you better be covered with blood, too. You know, it's that motherly thing. You know, if he takes a beating, you take a beating. If you both die, well, at least you both died. We'll do two funerals. But you don't come. And we were, like I said, very young. I was 8, and so he would have been 10. He's 2.5 years older than me. And that just changed him. Like a switch went off, and he became Rambo brother after that. And he can do it, too. And so from then on, I would have all of these, circumstances where bullies would try to pick on me. And if he was around, when I would find out one day this bully and I got into it because I was trying to protect another friend, and this bully was just going to kill me. He was huge. And my brother never even said anything. He just, met him at the bus stop the next day and just knocked the tar out of him. And then, my brother never even said a word to me. And I find out, I wonder how come that guy's not coming to pick it. Well, you didn't hear your big brother beat him up. I'm like, right on. Right on. Cool. And just over and over through the years, one day a high school kid, when I was only in the fourth grade, a high school kid knocked me out. And I was out cold. And Scotty took this kid on. And Scotty was about 1.5 feet shorter than this kid. And this guy hit Scotty. So Scotty looked like a raccoon. His eyes were bright red. His eyes were almost just swollen from this guy hitting him in the face. And I remember standing there. I had woke up from being knocked out. This is not a pleasant, I don't know how to tell you guys these things. Anyway, so I sit there, but I remember, being dazed from being knocked out and watching my brother take a beating for me. And it produced such admiration in my heart that has never faded over all the years. So that's why he can get away with calling me my childhood nickname, but don't you dare try to use it. He can get away. He can still beat me up, too. That's another reason. But I think in this family dynamic that was so fractured and so self-centered and so attacking, really, of one another, but as the 20 years had went by, God had changed their hearts, and these boys had went from wanting to hurt one another and sell one another and abuse one another to saying, make me your slave instead of them. See, their hearts are being tested. And I'd say Judah passes the test. Judah's a different guy. Judah finally lays down his life because he can't bear the thought of Benjamin be a slave, but he also cannot bear the thought of seeing the tears and the grief that's going to affect his father. You see, only when you begin to think outside the box of your own self-centeredness and you care how it's going to affect this brother and you care how it's going to affect your dad and you care how it's going to, what if you were to walk out on your wife this week? How's it going to affect her? How's it going to affect your 12-year-old boy? You see, the self-centered person just says, I'm out of here. I'm gone. I don't care. I don't care about anybody but me. You don't think about them. See, love looks this direction and says, how can I impact other people for good? Selfishness says, all of life is about me. I'm going to do whatever I want to do. You don't care who you hurt. You don't care who you trample underfoot in the process. Just as long as you have the freedom to do your own self-centered thing. And people in that place have told me over the years as I've looked at heartbroken people, and they said, hey, it's no one's business. I'm not hurting anybody.
said, man, you're blind. Look around at who you're hurting. Look around. They're blind. They can't see it. You know, in the course of your life, you're going to experience some real seasons and circumstances of testing. God's in the middle of it. And he's wondering, have you grown over these last few years? Have you grown? Is there a greater love quality in your life as you affect other people? Or is there a greater shriveling and selfishness that's bringing hurt and harm? It's a simple thing. You don't have to look or think very long before you know the answer for yourself.